Are gains for racialized people being rolled back by Trump's second term as president, as well as the MAGA movement? Is the BRICS an alternative for global South countries hoping to escape white supremacy? Why are so many achievements of black people in Canada going unacknowledged from Canadian history? How would the expunged history of black people in Canada affect the policy of Canadians in present and future? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we return to the theme of Black History Month and examine the underlying but unstated white supremacism which is still expressing itself today. In our first half hour, we hear from the scholar-activist Tina Renier about the United States turning against people of color under Trump and the MAGA movement, and about some of the ways we could reverse the tide. Then in our second half hour, we hear from the acclaimed Canadian historian Afua Cooper about the various examples of black people in Canada being marginalized in the history books and about what is gained by hiding past crimes from public consciousness. On this week's program, Black History Month Special, Trump 2.0, MAGA, and the ongoing erasure of black people from conscious awareness. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 28th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. We acknowledge that our access to the land and its resources came from the Indigenous people and the agreements that were made with them. May we seek restoration and reconciliation with them for the crimes of colonialism and genocide directed toward them, and continue forward in a respectful partnership. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Since Brexit, Paris has been quite worried that it would be left as the junior partner, as it previously relied on the Anglo-French alliance to counter Berlin's economic might. Thus, both Western European powers used the NATO-orchestrated Ukrainian conflict to reduce Germany's dominance in the EU while hoping to also inflict damage on Russia. The neo-Nazi project in Western-occupied Ukraine was one of the useful tools to accomplish both of these goals, primarily by breaking up any form of closer economic ties between the Kremlin and Berlin. This accomplished the goal of the latter's deindustrialization. However, with the Kiev regime now collapsing due to a combination of factors such as the growing Russian might and the new Trump administration, the EU-NATO is trying to save this geopolitical carcass by getting directly involved. That comes from the article, EU-NATO keeps poking the Russian bear, still wants troops in Ukraine, by Drago Bosnick, posted February 27th, originally published on InfoBricks. Typical of U.S. mainstream media's reporting of events is today's Wall Street Journal headline announcing a pact was reached. The only details reported, however, is that Ukraine, quote, would pay some proceeds from future mineral resource development into a fund, unquote, and that, quote, existing oil and gas production would be exempt from the deal, unquote. More revealing is the reference that, quote, the size of the U.S.'s stake in the fund and joint ownership deals will be hashed out in future agreements, unquote. In short, it all looks like a PR compromise between Trump and Zelensky to lower the accusations and public feuding between them that had been rising in intensity in recent weeks. Both Trump and Zelensky make token concessions to make it appear as if a deal exists and leave the critical details unclear. That comes from the article, The Real Trump-Zelensky $500 Billion Minerals Deal, Dr. Jack Rasmus, by Dr. Jack Rasmus, posted February 27th, originally published on jackrasmus.com. Hard-nosed billionaire and businessman Larry Fink, with the help of facilitator-in-chief Starmer, sees a golden opportunity to further hollow out Britain for the benefit of global finance. The criticism that Keir Starmer lacks vision is too kind. His vision, if we can call it that, seems to be selling Britain by the pound, a metaphorical fire sale of remaining national assets and potential while struggling to articulate a compelling narrative for the future to ordinary people. Starmer's leadership is more about managing decline than charting a new course, despite his talk of making Britain a global leader in AI, an area in which the US and China are already well ahead. After years of conservative austerity and Brexit turmoil, Britain now has another unpopular prime minister who seems content to peddle its future piece by piece. That comes from the article, Starmer, quote, selling Britain by the pound, unquote, by Colin Todd Hunter, posted February 26th. With Hamas, October 2023, crimes ever more distant in the rearview mirror, and Israeli crimes still all too visible in Gaza's complete destruction, amounting to a quote-unquote plausible genocide, according to the International Court of Justice, or ICJ, Israeli leaders have been desperately trying to shift attention to a fresh narrative battleground. They need a new set of lies to justify resuming the slaughter. And as ever, the Western establishment media are actively assisting. Both Hamas and Israel are playing a predictable propaganda game, using the regular exchanges of Israeli and Palestinian hostages in the ceasefire's first phase to seize the moral high ground. Israel once again has all the cards, care of rock-solid Western support, and yet once again it is failing to win the public relations war. That comes from the article, Netanyahu only ever saw the hostages as his path back to genocide, by Jonathan Cook, posted February 27th, originally published on Middle East Eye. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. In Donald Trump's inauguration speech as President of the United States, the very first policy move he mentioned would be to declare an emergency at the southern border to halt illegal entry into the country and to begin to return millions of what he called criminal aliens back to the countries from which they came. According to my first guest, this policy shift is an example of the Make America Great Again foreign policy agenda, which derives its influence ultimately from a combination of a siege mentality, religious fundamentalism, and American exceptionalism that has been raging actually for a few years now and naturally gets expressed through the Trump device. Tina Renier is the author of that article. She's an Afro-Jamaican scholar activist. She's also a research fellow for the Sustainable Leadership and Positive Peace Research Fellowship Program, a UNESCO Inclusive Policy Lab expert, and a regular contributor to Global Research, and a past guest of this program. She received a Master of Arts in International Development Studies from St. Mary's University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. And the article in question is called The Shockwave Implications of MAGA Mandate for Immigration, Gender, and International Trade. She joins us now. Good to hear from you again, Ms. Renier. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
It's a pleasure to have me invited on this show once again, Michael, and it's a pleasure contributing to progressive academic and activist discourse.
So, in America, many people who work hard and follow the American dream are still falling behind. And for the MAGA set, people of color, or some people of color, like the Haitians or the Latin Americans or people from Islamic countries, appear to be the scapegoat. Is that what is happening now? Is that the essence of what we're talking about, or is it more complex than that?
It is a combination of that and more complex than that. But let us start with this simple. As a social scientist, we have to start with what is observable to people, especially if we are wanting to reach a larger audience for understanding. Let us start with what we are observing, and then we get to the more complex things. So the first thing that we are observing is that vulnerable populations, whether it be the Muslims, the LGBTQ community, women, the elderly, young people, unattached groups, persons with a criminal history. All of these are different categories of migrants, whether legal or illegal. And migrants have been always viewed as threats to national security. And I want to situate this discussion in America's long trajectory of migration governance. So, yes, we are aware of these effects in terms of racialization, coloniality, and imperial policies, but it's important to note that this is further amplified under Trump's agenda of America First. It has always existed, dating back to the 1700s with the Dawes Act in America, outlining detainment and punishment for certain groups of migrants. Now, what America First represents, it is a xenophobic nationalist sentiment in which migrants are blamed as the causes for America's social and economic ills. And we see that being echoed on the Project 2025 mandate and the neoconservatives' Republican electoral platform leading up to the election. Now, with the passing or signing of specific executive orders, we see millions of migrants being migrated, but we need not look at migrants as a homogeneous group. We need to look at migrants across age group, across race, across ethnicity, across social class, gender identity, sexual orientation, and the different degrees of vulnerability produces different degrees of risk and exclusion. The other thing that I would like to touch on is using an analytic framework. So we are looking now at the broader implications of the America First policy. There's a scholar by the name of Karsha Walia. She coined the term border imperialism. And border imperialism encompasses four major things. So first, building an apartheid migration and citizenship regime that allows for certain rights and entitlements to be afforded to American citizens, while those who are considered to be the others, including migrants, including Muslims, including women, including those groups that you have mentioned, they are excluded. So that's the first component. The second component deals with exploitation of labor in industries that are similar to slave-like conditions for servitude. We see that in migrants being employed in precarious industries, especially those who are also deemed as illegal or undocumented. The other aspect of border imperialism is violent displacement and dispossession. And we see this in the example of many of the illegal migrants or criminal migrants with a criminal history from countries in the Latin American and Caribbean region. As a matter of fact, over 5,000 Jamaicans who have been undocumented have returned home a couple of weeks ago, even though the Jamaican government wasn't fully prepared in terms of national development strategies to integrate them.
Wow. As I understand it, I mean, I know you talked about not only the racially marginalized, but the gender identity, the LGBTQAIA plus part of our society, women, and these views seem to stem from religions. I mean, are you saying that?
Yes, Christian, evangelical foreign policy. So Trump being neoconservative, and if we pay attention to the history of other Republican presidents, they have pushed an evangelical foreign policy. And one of the effects of an evangelical foreign policy is stressing things like the traditional Western nuclear family that is predicated on heterosexual norms and ideologies. So naturally, because that's one of the effects, it is reverting back to an age in which things like biological essentialism was stressed, where there are strict gender roles and expectations of men and women. This is echoed in one of his recent executive orders earlier this year, where Trump only recognizes two genders, man or woman. And what that does to the LGBTQ community is further, it results in further exclusion, further marginalization, further acts of state-sanctioned violence towards the community. And particularly, not just LGBTQ migrants who identify as American citizens, but those who are in precarious conditions who are also migrants as well. So that's an added layer of complexity. We also need to look on the cutbacks on public spending on gender diversity programs and initiatives, and how that is affecting various institutions, whether these are workplaces or universities that had a traditional statement as it relates to employment equity hiring, as it relates to gender. So that is going to not just push back on the years of hard fought for gains by different activists and scholars, but it's going to pose a new challenge and perhaps open up the possibilities for new forms of resistance against the far-reaching effects of the Trump first, America first agenda.
Yeah, we should talk about that a little later. But I just wanted to mention that in our previous interview, we talked about how countries with racialized communities, which undergo emancipation, overthrowing in print the colonizers, still seem to have features of a colonized country. You know, the patterns of force are not overthrown so easily,
Exactly.
and.
So while there is a legal recognition in terms of emancipation, and yes, we are emancipated on paper, and yes, there are international conventions as it relates to human rights and conventions against genocide, what we I think we need to accept, which is why I first situated the debate that this did not begin with Trump. Trump amplified the political atmosphere and effective modalities of his supporters within America, which are essentially xenophobic nationalists or white supremacist social movements and sects of people, including the billionaires such as Elon Musk. And when I say America is the epitome of empire, I mean that empire in the sense of imperial nation building practices, and imperial nation building practices includes expropriation of resources, exploitation of racialized and feminized identities, labor. It also includes using new tools or strategies of domination, which is working through this international institution, which I will go into a little later about the impacts of withdrawing from a number of important international institutions, such as the World Health Organization, and also putting a freeze on US aid for healthcare and education in developing countries.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are these organizations, the IMF and the WTO, which seem to be components of the architecture of financialization, which basically the stack is rigged in favor of the white supremacist organizations, basically, as we discussed last time. But however, in your article, you mentioned that this trend is getting pushed back by the BRICS arrangements, Russia, China, Brazil, and also
Yes,
the
there
increasing
have
number of
been
countries from the global south that are joining in.
the alternatives to challenging Western financialization of international institutions. So one of the alternatives that come up through global or South-South cooperation has been Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And one of the things I've been paying attention to is their establishment of the New Development Bank. A number of countries from the Global South have become associate or full members of the BRICS. But the difference between the New Development Bank versus a World Bank or International Monetary Fund, they provide attractive loans on issues such as ecological sustainability, right? Inclusive social and economic development, right? But compared to the IMF and the World Bank, they are pushing a neoliberal economic policy agenda with structural adjustments that prioritize privatization, deregulation, cut back on social spending on programs such as healthcare and education. But with the NDB, it does not necessarily do that. So there is possibilities for alternatives within a hegemonic economic policy reform discourse.
Well, the look talking about alternatives and resistance. I know in Weimar Germany there were progressive gains made in society that basically were pushed back by the rise of Nazism. It essentially is a backlash against this the wave of these difficulties, and it seems like we're seeing the U.S. developing into a kind of a Fourth Reich or something similar. What could you say to citizens outside of the US, well, what can we do I mean, you mentioned the BRICS, but what can we do as individuals to try to contain the spread of this kind of thinking in our own countries and to possibly even reverse what is happening in the United States?
So one of the things I've definitely reflected on even before preparing and submitting that article, the global research, is that many of us, we are a part of advocacy networks. And these advocacy networks don't necessarily have to be formal development institutions like what the BRICS have done. We have our informal networks that engage in public engagement that are connected to communities that are also connected to the vulnerable populations that are affected by these policies. So I would say increase in public engagement initiatives, increase in capacity building for advocacy. So the traditional ways of doing advocacy may be writing letters to MPs or local leaders in power, that might not necessarily work as the effects of these policies are transnational. Perhaps looking into new ways of public engagement and advocacy using platforms such as social media and technology, maybe tapping into digital activism for social and economic justice.
Okay, well, that's really interesting. I'm just pretty much fascinated with these efforts. And just any last words in terms of moving forward with Trump's continuing with his policies of seemingly unchecked?
So I am seeing internally within the US backlash and advocacy from Democratic representatives from progressive circles in academia, in public policy, in non-governmental organizations that have been affected by freezes, aid freezes, and cuts. However, that kind of advocacy and pushback not only needs to have a clear message, it also needs to be sustained over time. I think the other thing that I am looking at that needs to come out from the advocacy is what we see in terms of the continuation of America. Trump, the second presidency, represents and not just a marriage between the public policy agenda and the role of unelected corporate interests. And we see that in the close relationship between Trump and billionaires like Elon Musk. And this should open further up the policy debate, not just on income and economic inequality, but progressive taxation policies targeting the billionaires that are constantly involved in exploitation of labor, expropriation of resources, environmental destruction, and also predominantly wealth and income inequality. And I think organizations such as Oxfam International have been doing extensive work on generating discussions on that kind of topic.
It was great having you on, Ms. Rainier. Thank you for being part of our show.
And thank you for having me once again, Michael. I look forward to ongoing collaboration and ongoing ways of engaging with the public and also even brainstorming recommendations or alternative possibilities within these challenging interconnected contexts.
Tina Rainier is a scholar and activist, and she's the author of the recent article, The Shockwave Implications of MAGA Mandate for Immigration, Gender, and International Trade. She joined us from Jamaica. For the next half hour, we're going to be talking about Black history in Canada with the perfect person, or arguably the most informed figure on the topic. Afua Ava Pamela Cooper is a Jamaican-born Canadian historian. As a historian, she has taught Caribbean cultural studies, history, women's studies, and Black studies at Ryerson and York Universities, at the University of Toronto, and at Dalhousie University. Afua Cooper was the former James Robinson Johnston Chair in Black Canadian Studies from 2011 to 2017. Her research interests are African Canadian studies, with special regard to the period of enslavement and emancipation in 18th and 19th century Canada and the Black Atlantic, African Nova Scotian history, political consciousness, community building and culture, slavery's aftermath, and Black youth studies. She's the author of The Hanging of Angelique, The Untold Story of Canadian Slavery, and The Burning of Old Montreal, and is the chair and founder of the Black Canadian Studies Association. She's also an author and dub poet who, as of 2018, has published 5 volumes of poetry. She is currently the principal investigator for the research project, A Black People's History of Canada. In December of last year, it was announced that she has become a recipient of the Order of Nova Scotia for her contributions as a historian, author, academic, and Halifax's poet laureate. She's also a former guest on this show. Afua Cooper joins us after a brief break. Please stay tuned.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
Professor Cooper, it is a delight and a treat to have you back on the Global Research News Hour. Welcome back.
Thank you, Michael.
In your public talks, you've remarked about how while there are testaments to immigration and while there are apologies from the federal government to injustices against indigenous people and the incarceration in Japanese Canadians, and rightly so, but I might add, there is still no apology for the enslavement of black people in Canada and of their historic roles in making and shaping Canadian history, culture, and heritage as enslaved persons, explorers, writers, scholars, fur traders, scientists, soldiers, nurses, porters, and musicians. There are gaps in our awareness, our historical awareness. Why is it that these gaps exist?
I think the most pertinent reason from my perspective is that these gaps exist. You talk about the lack of apology to the Black community. So these gaps exist because anti-Black racism is still a fact of life in our society, in our country. This whole issue of worthiness, perhaps the federal government doesn't see black people as being worthy of an apology, deserving of an apology. Anti-blackness is braided throughout our history here in Canada. You're in the West, and in 1911, from our federal parliament, it was then called the Dominion of Canada, an order in council was issued by the Laurier government, liberal government. Banning black people from immigrating to Canada, black people from anywhere in the world. This order in council ban was targeted to the African Americans who were emigrating, leaving the United States, the Western states or the Plains states to come to the Canadian Prairie provinces. And if we go before 1911, there are all kinds of ordinances and laws and policies that were specifically anti-Black that were created to further oppress Black people. So that's why I think these gaps exist. I must say that there are several local or private apologies. So, for example, the Royal Ontario Museum in 2016 issued an apology to the Black community for its racism in that exhibit that was put up at the ROM 1989-1990 called Into the Heart of Africa. And it pretty much devastated the Black community because so many people were arrested because of the protest. And, in addition, the exhibit really demeaned Black people. So something like 25, 26 years later, an apology was issued. Then the city of Halifax also in 2010, 2011 issued an apology for the destruction of Africville. There an apology was issued to the descendants of the Black men who were in the number 2 Black Battalion of World War I. So there are all these what I call maybe local apologies, but nothing, not a global apology, not a national apology to the Black community for these centuries of slavery and oppression. So just to summarize, I think it falls at the feet of the gaps fall at the feet of anti-Black racism.
Could you give us a couple of examples going way, way back to the 1600s, the territory that we now call Canada, of the diminution and even the erasure of profound black historical importance?
Thank you, Michael, for that question. We know the first person for black person for whom we have a record entering Canada or was contracted to work for Sieur de Gouademont and for Samuel de Champlain in Acadia, between 1604 to 1608. Acadia, for your listeners, are Nova Scotia, New Brunswick. Prince Edward Island and even part of Quebec could fall into that. But in this case, it was Nova Scotia. So Matthew da Costa, this man who is described as a Portuguese African and was free, he signed his own contract to work for the French as an interpreter between the French and the Mi'kmaq Nation on the East Coast. So he was multilingual. He spoke French, Dutch, the Mi'kmaq languages, certainly, and also Portuguese. And it's important to know that he entered history as a free person, entered Canadian history. So that is huge because here's this man who was working for the French. One could say, you know, he was part of the colonizing mission. But, you know, we know so much more about Champlain. We know so much more about Sieur de Gouadement, who was the governor of Acadia at the time. And as we, as the 16th, as the 17th century, rather, as the 17th century matured, by the end of the 17th century, we find the people, the black people are coming into Canada, are enslaved people. So in 1629, we have an enslaved boy, around 9 years old, by the name of Olivier Lejeune, whom we are told came from Madagascar. So this period of enslavement from 1629, beginning with Olivier Lejeune, to 1834, by now Canada is a British colony, and the British abolished slavery in 1834. You have what, 206 years of enslavement that has just been swept under the carpet. Then you think when slavery ended, the segregated societies, Jim Crow-like conditions that existed in Canada with respect to the black community. They were denied economic opportunities, forced into segregated schools, so on and so forth. So one could I can talk about all of that. But at the same time, I want to say there was a lot of resistance to this oppression, to this indignity, to these acts of inhumanity. But at the same time, it really took a lot away from the black community to be always beating against the barriers, to be always asserting their humanity. And I think it's important that this be recognized. And you know, the black community and certainly many of the black leaders or change makers be recognized, be acknowledged for the work they did in building Canada. Because in every epoch of, you know, the Canadian history, there were black communities where there were black individuals sleeping car porters, making, you know, the trains run from coast to coast. And the building of the National Railway was an important part of nation building. I should also say that the building of the National Railroad, this policy put in place by Sir John A. Macdonald, also came to, you know, to oppress the indigenous people on the prairies because it was their land through which the tracks were laid. And as you know, Michael, several wars were fought on the prairies between indigenous people and the white settler colonizers. So if we look from Newfoundland to all the way to BC and beyond to the north, you see black communities, black individuals have played their part in ensuring that this society we have, a prosperous society for many people, ensuring that it came into being, but they haven't been given the recognition.
Yeah, I think you made an interesting point about how the oppression and resistance were interlinked, and it seems to me that there are, I mean, the idea is if you don't, okay, so they were oppressed, but we won't acknowledge the resistance because it might give either them or other people ideas. So I mean, just give me one example you'd like to that really illustrates this point.
I think the example that comes to mind, and I'm bringing it up because there's a new book on the topic. There's the book by Marie Carter, and it's called In the Light of Dawn. And Marie Carter looks at the Dawn Settlement in the Dresden area of southwestern Ontario. And that was a black settlement, in the mid 1850s, 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, and beyond. There were many prosperous black farmers, black people who came there. They set up industries, they set up farms, literary societies, they built schools and established churches. But if you fast forward 100 years into the future, in the 1850s, you see that Jim Crow-like laws, Jim Crow simply means in this case segregation or segregated conditions, existed in the town of Dresden, where Don was a part of Dresden. And you're thinking, wow, black people have contributed so much to this town. But 100 years later, in the 1850s, everything was segregated for the black community. Black people were oppressed. They were discriminated against. And then you have an organization founded called National U Unity Association. And there was a gentleman by the name of Hugh Burnett, who was at the head, was one of the leaders of this organization. Now, Hugh was a carpenter by trade from Dresden, married, lived there with his children. And so they began to agitate. They wrote letters, they held meetings. And it went to Toronto. Premier Frost was, Mr. Frost was premier at that time. Then in the 19, throughout the 50s, from the Ontario legislature were promulgated new laws about the Fair Accommodations Act that pertained to housing, because many people would not rent to Black people, Fair Employment Act. What we would call these acts as civil rights legislation. And people like Hugh Burnett from Dresden, Ontario, was instrumental with other with allies and with other colleagues in having these acts passed for all of that particular province. But he paid a price. People in the town stopped giving him business. This is a person he went from a good salary to zero. People stopped patronizing him. The white people in the town were so upset that he and others shone a light on the racism in that town. So there was the resistance. Certainly the black people in that town resisted, and they said, "We're not going to take this. Our children are worth something. They have a right to go to school and be taught and be treated with dignity." But people like Hugh paid a dear price. And he had to move away from the community. It doesn't always end like that, but we also have to know that this can also happen, the oppression, the resistance, and the consequences. At this, and I could speak about Bromley Armstrong, who was also involved in the Dresden situation. But Bromley Armstrong, along with some other colleagues in Ontario, went to Ottawa to say to the federal government, this ban against black immigrants, because blacks could come in, Michael, they could come in, but as farm workers, as domestic servants, and maybe one or two students, but not as immigrants, not as landed immigrants. People coming to Canada to start a new life, they were allowed to enter as temporary residents. And so people like Bromley and others, Don Moore, they went to Ottawa and said, this is not right. Over the course of several years, they wrote letters, they traveled to Ottawa and met their respective representatives. And until finally, this act banning black migration and other racialized migration of other racialized people was lifted in 1962 under the Diefenbaker premiership. So it is a long journey, and but I always say it's to me it's this constant struggle. And now we see we have our children in school, and there are some teachers who just feel black children should not succeed, and try to dampen the light that they come in with in the schools. So We have always been beaten against the barriers, and I don't think it's left up to the Black community anymore to fight what we will and to say to people, "Hey, we're worthy," But it's the white community that has a problem now, because they're the ones who started this racism. They are the ones who need to go anti-racist.
There were people brought to Canada by slave owners from Maine and places around there going up into Canada, and the people there were slaves, but there was also a period where there were free black people there, and then they kind of intermingled with each other, did they not?
Yes, there was a time, especially in the eastern provinces or the maritime provinces, and also in Quebec and Ontario, where you had enslaved black people living beside or working with free black people. A classic example of that would be the Loyalist era. So the American Revolutionary happened, the American colonies revolted against Britain. Those who supported the American colonies were called patriots, and Mother Country Britain, those who supported that, the British cause, were called loyalists, loyal to the crown. The Americans won the war, and so thousands and thousands of Americans, because they were that, who supported Britain, had to leave the new United States. So we know something like 40,000 people came to the Maritimes, and maybe 10,000 or more between what is now Quebec and Ontario. And many of the those loyalists who came to the Maritimes were freed blacks, because they had fought for the British during the American Revolutionary War. They had run away from slavery, joined the British standard, fought for the British, survived the war, and the British had promised them freedom upon, once the war ended. So the British transported upwards of 3,500 of those freed black men, women, and children to the maritime colonies, and also to Upper Canada and Lower Canada, which are Ontario and Quebec. But the white loyalists also brought their enslaved property with them, enslaved black people. So you had that situation in which, as I've said before, free black people were working alongside with enslaved black people. Well, it's kind of weird, but it was so it was. And it led to a number of I would say situations where many free black people were presumed to be slaves and were kidnapped and re-enslaved and sold out of the colonies or the provinces into United States, further south and into the Caribbean. And many people who were enslaved, they saw free black people, so they knew a different life was possible, and they started running away from slavery. So it was an interesting moment. I must also add that with this issue of slavery, it wasn't only confined to the older colonies east. You found enslaved Africans in places like we're in Manitoba, in the prairies. And here's why. There are many slave owners from, say, people places like Montreal, who were fur traders, who were important fur traders. But they were also involved in the West Indies trade. They were business people, so they were also sending goods, dry goods, and other types of goods down to the West Indian plantations. And in return, they would import rum, sugar, molasses, cocoa, coffee, not just to the West Indian plantation, but also to South America and Central America. So there was this trade between the slaver colonies in the West Indies and South America, and between the Canadian colonies. And as I said, many of these businessmen were fur traders who were involved in the fur trade in the Payon, which is, you know, like northern Ontario into Manitoba, all the way into Alberta. And so there were enslaved people working as canoemen or musicians or in other capacities in Manitoba and the Prairie provinces. So slavery had a long reach in Canada. And in studying this topic, I realized quickly that I had to take my mind out of, you know, this context that slavery meant a big plantation where people are picking cotton or cutting sugar cane. Slavery was multi-dimensional, especially in a place like Canada where we didn't have sugar plantation or cotton plantations. We had a household domestic form of slavery, and there was another arm to it, that of the fur trade. So as we go along, we discover more knowledge, we gain more knowledge as we do more research, and then you see how deep you begin to uncover the layers of slavery in Canada.
So generally speaking, I find that Canada maintains the illusion of being a more just and humane society than the United States, and we're basically hiding from the reality of past crimes. I mean, it's expunging history. Could you comment on how you think the hidden past of our treatment and diminution of Black history is affecting our policies going into the future?
I would say that going into the future, we can look at current immigration policies. And certainly if you think of when we confederated in 1867, and that's, you know, the beginning of a new construct of Canada. But part of the ideology in creating this confederation was, in terms of national development, or, you know, how are we going to move forward as a country? How do we see ourselves as? Well, it was perceived as a white man's country. Sir John A. articulated that, his associates, journalists, and as we enter the, and especially when you want to think of the building of the national, the railroad was part of the national policy in bringing, unifying the different provinces of Canada, and, you know, Alberta joining Confederation in 1905 and Saskatchewan and Manitoba in 1872. It was perceived of as a white man's country. And that's not just a fool Cooper saying that. The officials in Ottawa, the intellectuals, they said this place is for the sons of Europe. I imagine they also meant daughters. And so that is why between 1895 and, let's say, 1920, 2 million people from Europe were brought in, primarily to the prairies, as you know. And many of them had their ship's fare paid for because Canada wanted white settlers. They wanted Nordic people. They wanted British people. But when they weren't getting the volume they required, they turned to Eastern and Southern Europe. And all of this, Blacks were not welcomed. So you have to ask yourself, what about the Black people who were living here before? Because, you know, it's a long history of Black settlement. And when you look at the conditions of Blacks who were living there before, Black people were surviving through their own efforts. And I want to make that clear, because whichever government it was, whichever provincial government, and certainly the Dominion government or federal government, were not interested in promoting or giving Black communities equal rights. So their dignity was constantly being chipped away every day. So when 1911 came around and the order in council that banned Black migration, you know, the few hundred people who were coming from Oklahoma and other prairie states, or plain states as they call it in the US, to Canada, that dried up quickly. So And I've said in 1962, there was an opening. If you look at today's current immigration policies, it's still it's very difficult for people from predominantly Black countries to get into Canada at this stage. You need to get visa to have a visa to come from most of the countries in the Caribbean. To come from Africa, that's work. That's a stretch. They have a class, like an entrepreneur's class in immigration, to migrate here. So if you can come up with $250,000, then you can get your visa and your landed papers. But most people don't have $250,000 or more, right? But just to get a visa to come in as a student from Africa is difficult. I know of so many cases where universities accept students from, say, Ghana or Nigeria or Congo. They're ready to start the semester. They can't get the visa from the Canadian visa office, wherever they're located. So there's still the practice against Black people migrating to Canada, especially from the continent of Africa, is still discriminatory. It's like, even though they have lifted the order in council and we have all these various multicultural acts and so on, there's still an anti-Black bias in immigration policies. So going forward, what I'm saying, Michael, is that we have a white majority now in Canada, but that wasn't through natural evolution or whatever. That was created. That was something that was created. In 1800, if we go back to 1800, the majority of people in Canada were Indigenous people. If you fast forward 100 years in the future or 200 years where we are now, that's not the case. So there was constant white immigration into Canada in many ways, in many situations, paid for by the federal or the Dominion government. Blacks were also banned. Then, there was a time when there was a restriction on Asian migration. But there's also a time in recent times where migration from Asia was what was preferred by the federal government, and so the doors were open to hundreds of thousands of people from these regions. That was never the case for Black communities in the Caribbean and in Africa.
Afua Cooper, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I know you've got to get busy with your project, but I want to thank you for making the time for us, and we look forward to seeing where the project for the Black History of Canada is going to take us. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Thank you, Michael.
The great Afua Cooper is a Jamaican-born Canadian.
The great Afua Cooper is a Jamaican-born Canadian historian, an author and dub poet, and the principal investigator for the Black People's History of Canada project. She spoke to us from Halifax. That's it for our show. Next week, we will be looking at International Women's Day and how the women's movement is, at best, a mask for Western foreign policy. Join us in 7 days. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show can air on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download on the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.